Another of the dismal mind states where when are we going to be over this? We have one more next week, the wanting mind. And I was with somebody the other day, and she said, oh, you haven't gotten to my mind yet. I said, what is that? She said, the insecure mind. I said, oh, my, another series. So we'll explore this one. But as we do, it's not so much the mind state. Well, we are exploring the mind state. I mean, the mind state is an important component of what we're talking about. But equally as important is the way, is the method we use to get to the spiritual aspects, to go deeper than the mind state's workings, and to go behind it to the pain that is being stated through that particular quality of mind. And so I hope this talk, even though it may not touch your top 10 tunes, although I can't imagine it doesn't, that you learn more about whatever state you might be feeling, about how to address it and how to work with it. And so tonight, the lonely mind. The lonely mind. Now, it's real important right up front that we realize that we're not trying to validate ourselves by studying these things. We're not trying to confirm our worst fears. I really am lonely. I really am desperate. I really am worried. But rather, we are just learning how to hold these states of mind, how to experience them without the identifying link there that claims ownership to them. And that's an important uncoupling that any spiritual tradition should point towards. And it's really where psychology and spiritual traditions separate. So we're not trying to validate who we are. I don't know. I watched the documentary on 9/11 last night and was, again, deeply touched by that program. And for those of you who didn't see it, it followed a particular firehouse through the whole 9/11 incident, where it just happened to be a couple of filmmakers who were following a rookie through his first year of being a fireman, and this was one of the incidences that the rookie faced. But what was interesting to me was that as the firemen went out together, battling these blazes and different things, and then when we come back, there was a kind of brotherhood that formed around them because of the risk, because of the vulnerability that they faced on each trip out. And of course, 9/11 accentuated that brotherhood even more because of the vulnerability that this particular firehouse went into the building and then went up the steps and then all happened to evacuate in time to be saved. But that sense of having reached a certain component in which they faced, in this case, almost certain death, only to survive, and then someone who has gone through that with them, the way that their hearts open to each other, having faced sort of been on the edge of the cliff and to come back. And that there was a real sense of connectedness, something that was much more affirming than the fear of the moment. And in fact, oftentimes this brotherhood drove them beyond where they normally would in their personal lives have arrested, and they kept moving. They went into the fire. And you think now for a moment, what the vulnerable heart does in terms of connectedness, and how we keep our hearts so sophisticated, so protected, so defended, that vulnerability is several layers down. And thereby, we never really intimate a sense of connectedness through much of our life, because we won't allow ourselves to feel the vulnerability that each one of us live with, whether we acknowledge it or not. I mean, we live on a precipice. If you think differently, read the obituary column sometime and find your name or your demographics or your age within that column. And yet so easily we just sort of pass that, whitewash that. Just pass over it. So what does that have to do with loneliness? I think it has a lot to do with loneliness. Because the more protected we are, the more defended we are, the more isolated we are. And although it may hold us in good stead for being able to have a sense of mastery and control, the illusion of mastery and control, I might add, the inevitable downside of that is that we are separate and cut off and distant. So I think of loneliness, I think of our ability to be alone. Our ability to be alone. How are we with our ability to be alone? When I do retreats, often people who have never done retreats come to me and say the hardest aspect of the retreat was the silence that they carry throughout the retreat, because there's no talking between people. And they say, I feel so lonely in that, so cut off, because many of us have not had a single day in which interaction wasn't the main focus, or dialoguing wasn't the main way that we became affirmed. We seek affirmation through someone else's glance, through someone else's eyes, through someone else's recognition of us. It's almost as if we're pulled out of our pain through someone else actually being able to say with their eyes, "I see you." And in retreat, we keep our eyes downcast. Why do we do that? Just for cruelty? No, it's because unless we cut ourselves off from all forms of distraction, all forms of affirmation from the outside sources, we never come to feel the depth of the loneliness that we carry. We never really touch that which drives much of our action, the pain of it, because we're too interested in assuaging the pain through getting recognition or attention from someone. Please see me. Please recognize me. I remember as a child feeling that. I was raised as one of five kids, and I wanting attention all the time, wanting attention, which is karmically probably why I'm up here. That need. Am I alive? And how simplicity and aloneness, I think the more we cultivate or allow simplicity into our life, the easier it becomes to be alone. I hesitate making these statements because there's always something that comes through that smashes the... But it's been a long, long time since I felt lonely. And it's because, I think it's because of the comfort of just being alone, of the heart's resonance and simplicity and stillness. And yet it's that very stillness that frightens us the most, because it affirms that we are alone. And our mind takes that sense of being alone and makes tragedy out of it. I'm cut off. I'm desperate. I'm needy. Because inside of ourselves is a deeper sense of self-doubt, that when we touch the silence, it's not aloneness we feel, it's the self-doubt we feel within the stillness, which we call loneliness. I can't stand this because I'm not being affirmed. And how much of our life is directed towards the strategies of distraction? How quickly, when we get into the car, do we turn on the radio? Or the TV? Or the CD player? How full is our utility belt with beepers and pagers and cell phones? And how much of that has not so much to do, though we certainly rationalize its use, well, I stay connected to my job, or I need this for my, or it's a sense of protection, or I feel safe with it, or is really a way just to be affirmed. Perhaps a feeling of importance is that affirmation. And where is wholeness in the midst of that? If we're running constantly from the deeper sense of personal dissatisfaction, self angst, how can we ever recover any sense of completion? How can we ever find it? It's nowhere to be found. It will never be found. And people are often so troubled by the depth of their own sense of adequacy. And please, all of us have some of that. So this isn't just you or me. All of us have some of this. It's engendered, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the culture and how it engenders it. And as one student was writing me an email inviting me to come back to a city that I have taught before, she said, "This time we'd like you to come and not be so political." I said, I'm not political. She said, "Well, your commentaries on the culture." But I think it's important to understand what the culture does to it. And I don't think that's a political statement at all. I want to know how I'm being molded by the forces of the culture so that I can understand myself better. I don't see that as a political statement. Because it seems to be, regardless of president, or regardless of party in power, or regardless of political persuasion, those forces continue. So Lord, are those forces that do that? And you see, I mean, is it any wonder that we have such self-doubt when we're not often affirmed for being who we are in a heartfelt, genuine way, because the culture is mostly interested in what it can sell us. So it's not really interested in us. It's interested in us, our health, our wisdom, our schooling, our education, if it has a product that is in line with that good. It's hard not to be, I mean, how could you not have a sense of, because the heart is secondary. In most cases, let me be not so absolute in my statement. In most cases, in most circumstances, the heart is secondary in this culture. So if the heart is secondary, it means that the humanity-to-humanity touch that we all most crave in order to be connected is infrequently there. And most of us have the memory of some parent, perhaps, if you're lucky, or a teacher, one, maybe, that spent time with you not to do anything to you, but just because of caring. And it made an impact for most of us. We felt it. We felt the genuineness of that relationship. My God. Is it a wonder that we're so lonely when we haven't been affirmed in any other way, and we can't know ourselves? How can we know or have a self-direction when it's all been based on manipulation, really? So within most of us, and may I say it's the rare individual that doesn't have that, there's often a desperate sense of loneliness. Understandable. Because when I feel someone manipulating, I'm going to protect myself. And I do that, that protection, that defensiveness, because I feel violated psychically and in other ways. I'm going to isolate and cut myself off from connection, because connection for me has been based upon false pretenses. They're not really interested in connecting with me. And so I defend myself. But the defense has sent me back further and further into the corners of the cave, further and further distant. So that now all I can hear is the residue of doubt and insecurity. So I have no foundation of self, of stability of self to be able to move out on. Now, you see, someone once said very skillfully that you have to be someone before you can be no one. And it is so true that we cannot move through this sense of defense, of brokenness that many of us feel about ourselves. We can't just say no self and I'm finished with that. Because we do that when we say no self and just try and be finished with it, just try to bring a no self to the broken sense of self I have, it's because it's too painful to acknowledge the broken sense of self I had, and I want to do an end run around this project and just get to what I feel might be completion, in whatever way I mean. And so how we do that is detachment, pulling back from, distancing ourselves. And many of us read spiritual literature in terms of that, but that's reading it in terms of the dysfunctional sense of self, the hurting sense of self, the neurotic self that hurts so bad it wants to pull back and can only pull back. And it reads equanimity as being unaffected, untouched. A safe place. See, we crave a safe place. These are always such light talks. And because we ourselves only know how to work, because we've been taught that way, because we've been trained that way, because our whole conditioning is to work with the products of the world, with ourselves, everything is form. We try to just bring on self-improvement, something better than this, some other way to get over this problem. But please, don't send me to the pain. It's like Brer Rabbit in the briar patch. Don't throw me in the briar patch. Right? That's where we do not want to go. Don't tell me, Rodney, to go into the pain of that. Because in the pain of that is the confirmation of the worst truths I hold about myself. The most depleted sense of who I am. And I have been working my whole life for decades to put space between myself and that pain and to shore myself up. And so this practice is equally as much about shoring ourselves up as it is about seeing what the self is. And they work simultaneous, in tandem, in lockstep with one another. Because as we are willing to move into the deeper layers of our pain and are able to hold our pain without reacting to the pain in defensive and protective ways, which just reaffirms the truth of the pain. Every time I react to the pain defensively by explanation, every time I hear a fault about myself, I explain myself away, right? Or protecting myself defensively by just not hearing, or other defense mechanisms. Every time I do that, I only do that because I believe the truth in which the pain holds. And therefore, I reaffirm, I strengthen that truth. I defend, the more I strengthen the truth of the lie contained in the pain about me and how bad and how awful and how whatever it is that the pain is saying that I am. And the more, to keep myself away from that pain, I try to distract myself for greater and greater. Because the pain is growing, I have to use greater, more reinforced means to keep myself distracted. Until we come to something like 911, in which all the defenses are blown away and your heart is raw. And there's no protection that can happen because there's nothing that can cover the heart so that that tragedy won't hurt. There's nothing, there's no protection possible for that. Except psychosis, maybe. So there's no protection, so I have nowhere to turn. I have nothing to reinforce anymore. It's done. It's over. There's a gap between my immediate need for distraction and the pain that is there. And so there's a gap in my activity, a space, a true silence. It also happens with loss or death. It can happen with any tragedy. Perhaps you felt it before the mind creates the woe and the romanticism of the scene and how terrible, how awful, how could anybody, how could they ever have done that? And why don't we go and before all that, the ruminations of the building back of protection, the reforming of the structure of protection, of fear, before that, there's just the silence, the stillness, just the stillness. Like this stillness. Where there's space, there's a hole, there's a gap. Where the heart rushes out from its confinement within loneliness, rushes out, pours out like a dam with a hole at the bottom of the dam. It doesn't rush out to activity, it rushes out to warmth and connectedness. It rushes out because it's the only chance it's had in its life to ever touch anything genuine. And in this stillness, there's nothing I need to be afraid of. It's all gone. In that moment, it's all gone. And the heart has just been waiting patiently to have some access, to have some way and you see the firefighters and you see New York City and you see people coming back within brotherhood and sisterhood in true connection of one vulnerable human being to another vulnerable human being who isn't trying to do anything to this vulnerable human being except be vulnerable with it, him or her. And each of us have an intimation that there's safety there. That's one of the reasons children bring our heart out, is that they're not doing anything to us. They're just being children. So our heart can move out free. Or animals. Because an animal isn't doing anything. In that poem I read to end the sitting, I'm among trees and sit still. All my stirrings become quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them, asleep like cattle. I've come into quietude, my own quietude. And what is afraid of me comes and lives while in my sight. And what it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. And all the fear within that silence can't be sustained. Fear can't be sustained in silence. So it just moves on. And then the last stanza, after days of labor, mute in my consternations, I hear my song at last and I sing it. As we sing, the I changes to we. As we sing, the day turns, the trees move. The I of the loneliness in silence and stillness changes to the we of connectedness, the we of connection. The we of connection. You see, this is Buddhism's wise view. Wise view is the view that the view from the eyes belie. The view from the eye is that there are two of us, you and me, separate and distinct and different and distinct. But the view from the heart that can be intimated but can't be seen, because we can only see through the eyes, through the brain, through the eyes. But the view from the heart is vastly different than that. As someone once said, we're not seeking new landscape, we're seeking new eyes. And so, how is it that we can move into this pain, this loneliness, to bring forth the wise view that the Buddha has spoken about and that we are trying to encourage in these meetings? Well, it's not the way that you want it to go. It's not the way of safety. It's not the way that you have struggled your whole life. It's not the way to eradicate loneliness so that you'll never feel lonely again. Nope. It's not the way so that you'll never hurt. Mm-mm. So that you'll be self-trusting, so that you'll have no self-unworthiness or dislike. Nope. And we may struggle endlessly with workshops and therapies to try towards that end, but that's not this way. This way is the way of connection at every level. At every level. So the first thing we have to connect with is that which is driving us irrationally, unmistakably, towards a cure. That troubled sense of self, that disturbed sense of who I am, that is the first area in which we have to plant our feet. That's the first time, perhaps, that we've had the courage not to run anymore, not to seek an end to loneliness, for this is not the way of meditation. This is not the way of a spiritual quest. We seek the end of nothing, and through that, there is the fulfillment of everything. Everything is fulfilled. Everything is affirmed. So the loneliness itself, which is the context of the retreat environment, if I can go back to that metaphor, where we're all silent, we keep our eyes down, and the first thing comes up is how disturbing it is to me, how lonely I feel. And we see that as a complaint, because that's what's been driving much of the attention seeking that we've done. So, the meditation teacher, hopefully, points the person and says, okay, this working perfectly. This retreat is working exactly the way it's supposed to. Now be with the loneliness, which is the last reason that most of us have come to the retreat. We wanted affirmation, connectedness, quiet mind, peace. And here we're having to deal with the worst problem that we can imagine, which is our sense of isolation. And there we are. There it is. But that's the first area of connectedness. Connectedness is not connecting with everybody else except my emotions. I don't want that. I would just like to connect with everybody else. I'll stare at everybody else's eyes. And you get all kinds of weird spiritual scenes that do that kind of thing. So the first line is what? Okay, what's driving me? You see, when we ask the question, where's their contentment in this moment? The first thing we come to when we ask that question is that there's no contentment with my loneliness. That's the antithesis of contentment. There can't be any contentment with that. I've got to get over my loneliness, then I can be content. That's the way we think. That's the way the mind thinks. It will always think that way. So we let that go. The first strategy, okay, get over this, you know, connect with people, go back, turn on your radio, is the one we let go of. Okay, wait a second now. The Buddha said something about pain, following the pain. Let me go to this sense of loneliness itself and connect with it. And now, for the first time, perhaps it's being affirmed. It's being recognized. It's being allowed. It's being allowed. When we run from it because of the hold it still has on us. It's still whipping us with its torturous message. But okay, so let me just listen to this message. And you know what? We find out that it's emotion and thought. That's what it is. That's the mind's battery of defenses. That's the only thing it can do to you. It can make you think, and it can make you feel. And if you're willing to feel and to think, then that's it. It has nothing else that it can do to you. So I sit here and I feel the torture. I feel the message of how. But the fear, if I touch this, then I'm going to become this message. Well, okay, I'll risk it. I'll risk being the wretched person that my loneliness tells me I am. I'll risk it because running from the loneliness just makes me more wretched. So I have nothing to lose. So, okay. So let me just touch this wretchedness. And what, it's thinking. I'm thinking. I'm wretched. I'm wretched. I'm wretched. And I'm feeling wretched. So what? So what? This should be an inspiration beyond belief. So what? That's not a so what dismissively. That's a so what because it doesn't mean anything. It's not a dismissive so what. We all have to feel that. Because loneliness is the heart doesn't know how to feel complete. Because the mind keeps betraying its need for completion by having us pursue objects and desires. If I want and bring in what I want into my sphere of influence, then I'll be complete. That's what the mind says. And the heart says, oh, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. But the mind says, well, you just haven't tried hard enough. You haven't gotten enough money. You haven't gotten enough possessions. Shut up, heart. Okay. So this is a true counterculture. But not political. All right, that's not the message of completion. So I've got to go the path of the heart, and therefore the path that's the most difficult. You know, all of these metaphors, all of these myths, like Star Wars, and all of the myths through the battle scenes and all of that, the myths, the Joseph Campbell myths, this is it. These are the battle scenes. This is the enemy. What's the enemy? My attitude, my belief, my thought about myself, my feeling, all of it from the past, conditioned by the past, from the past, coming forth in the present moment. It's only the past. All I have to do is allow the past to come through the present, not to reaffirm the past in the present, but just let it pass through, like water through a pipe. So it's just pouring out. I'm no good. This is no good. I can't. I just... And if we turn the faucet all the way up, it only has so much force before it starts just dying down. It only lasts so long. Now, move into the spiritual realm, in which I'm no longer governed by the neurotic thoughts and emotions. And once I've gotten by the worst case scenario, which is the worst fear those emotions say that I am, the worst thing, once I'm willing just to sit with that worst thing, comes wholeness and completion. Because it was only in the running from that which kept me incomplete and lonely. Now that I have allowed it to be, just allowed it, its message is dead. Its message is dead. And so is the emotion that drives it. Now, there is reverence in aloneness. There is the sacred. So let us ask, in the depth of despair, in the moment of greatest self-angst and anxiety, where is there contentment in this? And let that be a spiritual quest. Let that be Star Wars Chapter 1. And let us move in and see what this is really about. Can we sit for a minute or two?